were engaged in, sorry to say, World War III. Hopefully it'll be a short one, short-lived. China is a absolute manufacturing powerhouse, the likes of which the world has never seen before. And nowhere is that more obvious than in the electric vehicle and battery supply chain business. Xi Jinping has come out and said, it is our time to take center stage in the world. The West is in decline, the East is rising, and it's now China's time. In Asia, you wake up in the morning, there's an urgency to get something done because someone else will eat your lunch if you don't. There's almost, it's a pressure cooker. The extent to which China has infiltrated U.S. society goes way beyond our wildest imagination.
Okay. So we have Michael back on the show. Michael has been with us a couple times. Michael is extremely knowledgeable with China. He has done Insights, which is a fantastic firm that gives companies insights into what the heck's going on in supply chain, electric vehicles, batteries, et cetera, specifically around China and stuff. So, but now the reason why we have Michael back is because the craziness with China with the tariffs is making everybody supremely confused, including the two of us, Hans and I, which we're especially confused because we're kind of dumb. But so we have Michael in to help us understand what the heck's going on. And then these guys were having a conversation while I was using the restroom, getting ready for the show. And then I was like, start now. So actually, I'm going to give it to you, Michael, because so... Yeah, Hans and I each have a thesis about what's going on, but we would love to hear from the person who has lived in China, been in China for decades, right? For a really long time. An extensive business in China. Please help us understand, give us the lay of the land so we can understand where this could be going. Thank you.
Coming into the conversation today, I couldn't help but to think a lot about something that happened 10 years ago in China. I was in Beijing at a private gathering sponsored by JP Morgan, and the guest of honor that evening was Henry Kissinger. And there he is, right in person. Here's Henry Kissinger, the guy who started it all way back in 1971. And he went on to tell us a story that I think is really, really important for our understanding of what's going on today. What was that story? For those of you not familiar with the history, he went to Pakistan on a diplomatic visit, and then in the cover of night, got on a secret airplane, flew up to Beijing. No one knew about it. And the idea was he'd get into Beijing, and he was escorted from the airport undercover to Zhongnanhai, which is the residence of the leaders of the Communist Party, in particular, Chairman Mao's residence. So he arrives at Chairman Mao's residence, is escorted into the foyer. What does he see? The first thing he sees is a big, giant ping pong table. No, Chairman Mao didn't play ping pong. He stacked it floor to ceiling, or ping pong table to ceiling, with books. He was an insomniac, couldn't sleep. Mao was a notorious insomniac, could not sleep, loved to read books. So he makes his way around the ping pong table, gets into the foyer. There's Zhou Enlai, his counterpart. And here comes Chairman Mao. So Kissinger relates how he went into his breast pocket, pulled out his piece of paper and said, Chairman Mao, on behalf of the United States, President Richard Nixon, and all American people, I'm so honored to be here in what could be very promising to be some kind of common ground between the United States and China, two proud nations with so much in common, so much to work on together. And so he paused. And then the interpreter began to tell the chairman what Kissinger just said. So the interpreter gets about 15 seconds into her translation, and all of a sudden Chairman Mao goes, Huzhua! Which in Chinese means bullshit. Actually, he said, you and I have very little in common. You're a new country. We've been around for thousands of years. You're a democracy. We're a one-party country. You're rich. We're poor. You're materialistic. We're not. In fact, the only thing we have in common is that you and I both don't like the Soviet Union. So let's be clear about where things really stand. And then Kissinger, of course, put the rest of his speech back into his pocket and said, yes, Chairman, I understand where you're coming from. So why is this story significant besides the fact that it's always so exciting to get the inside scoop? But in the beginning, what were our common interests? We really didn't have many. And for many years, we got along trying to find a way to get along until we find ourselves today more or less in direct confrontation. Like, hold on, what do you guys believe in? What do we believe in? And are they aligned? And that's the underlying friction that gives rise to this showdown that we're seeing today between the United States and China.
Yeah, and there's so much to unpack there, right? I mean, it is really interesting with the whole tariff discussion, and I made a post about this early last week when Trump initially showed that now infamous list of nations that got the tariffs with China at the very top, right? And yes. Then when China was one of the EU, Canada, other areas, you know, sort of were upset about the tariffs. I can't remember if Canada or the EU retaliated before China. But when China retaliated, then the U.S. very specifically honed in only on China and said, oh, you're the one who's retaliating. We're coming after you. And at that point, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. So the thing that we've had Michael on the show for the last couple of times, the thing we always talk about on the channel, which is China has been on a dramatic upswing, and the West and the United States specifically has been on a downswing, specifically around manufacturing, supply chain, national security, identifying technologies of the future that we're building, manufacturing capacity in the nation, all the things we've been talking about. I'm like, oh, well, could it actually be? And let's set aside the politics of agree or disagree with the approach. Could it actually be that the United States is putting in some sort of action to try and address this, right or wrong? And at that moment, I'm like, aha. There's no other reason why you would do that, it seems like. Like, okay, we can talk about like creating more fair trade, creating, of course, we all want that. But to me, the overarching trend has been the U.S. is getting worse and China is getting better. And it's getting dangerously close, hopefully, you know, no pun intended, no pun intended, hopefully doesn't become reality, that both countries are starting to compete for dominance. And when you have that sort of scenario, very bad things could happen. Mm-hmm. So do you think this is a fair characterization, Michael?
Absolutely, 100% on target. The thing that's a little bit confusing, of course, is that President Trump came out initially attacking neighbors, Canada and Mexico. Then he went after Europe, and you're thinking, okay, a logical approach would be get together with your allies and say, we have a competitor that's taking us on and wants to take us down. Let's all get together and make an allied approach, like in World War II or any other time. What's interesting is that maybe President Trump felt like if he took that approach, there wouldn't be urgency. They'd be, okay, yes, that makes sense, and we understand, we'll help you, but it would be half-hearted. Interestingly, he got everyone's attention in the entire world, upset and up in arms. What's tariffs on Canada? What? Mexico? What? Europe? Got everyone's attention. Then he goes, oh, by the way, you guys who are our allies? Whoa. I think we just had an earthquake here.
Really?
Oh my goodness.
Oh, I can see it. I think I can see it.
Oh my God. That's holy wild. Can you hold on a second?
Do what you gotta do. Okay. The Chinese are coming. Watch out.
Oh man.
That's intense. Michael, you're in California?
Confirm, yes.
Okay, all right. Then, okay, that makes sense. I'm like, all right. He seems pretty calm for an earthquake. Everything okay?
Everything's good. Okay, I just stepped outside and the neighbor said, confirm, that's an earthquake.
Holy shit.
It's a miniature one. It's a baby one, but...
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, just like that. The house was shaking.
That's crazy. How often do you guys get earthquakes down there?
I think often, that's the first time here in San Diego I've experienced an earthquake.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Holy shit. And how long have you been in San Diego?
10 years.
No way.
Yes. Okay. So most of it happens... LA yeah. and north, you know,
by the fault line. Yeah. So we were talking about, yeah. we were talking about, so the thesis around this whole thing being a try to either slow down China's prominence, and the United States seems like they're finally doing something about it. And you said something about, you know, the approach that Trump is taking with the tariffs seems crazy, but it seems to have brought everybody to the table.
It does. It got everyone's attention. And then just last week, he said, oh, by the way, our allies get a 90-day reprieve. That's my view. Now, there's word from people I know inside the Trump administration, Trump won, that said, if you remember, he tried to craft a deal with China at that time, a grand bargain where they would reduce basically the trade surplus with the United States. In Trump's view, they never honored that commitment. And they didn't. So he said, oh, I really have to hone in on this country because it's going to take a monumental effort to bring them to the negotiating table, high stakes, and make everyone feel it. And there's risk involved. So that's where we are. That's where we are.
Yeah. Do you think, one of the things that I'm seeing floating around, my read on the thing is that it doesn't seem like this is going to come to a resolution anytime soon. To me, this feels like I think the 90-day window is the time that Trump is almost giving himself to try and figure out something with China specifically, because that's my guess is the estimation of what the administration thinks they can push the economy to the limit until before something catastrophic happens. Because I feel like that's the sort of, it's like this all sounds existential, but I think it is existential because of I don't think people truly understand the amount of work that has gone into that the Chinese have put into preparing themselves for a potential future where they are the world superpower. And if they are the world superpower, that by default means being able to rival anybody, right? And so that's my read. It's like this doesn't get solved next week because of how complex and existential it is. But if it doesn't get solved in 90 days, something worse could happen. Would you say that's what's your take on that?
Totally accurate. We're in new territory. I thought it was highly significant last week that Elon Musk came out and said he thought it would be a great idea if Europe and the United States had zero tariff.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. He didn't say Europe and China and the United States. He said Europe and the United States. And by extension, other allies like Japan, Korea, Canada, Mexico, eventually, it would take all of our scale and resources and capabilities to compete with. Let's be honest, China is a absolute manufacturing powerhouse, the likes of which the world has never seen before. And nowhere is that more obvious than in the electric vehicle and battery supply chain business. We know that they build 10 times as many electrics as we do here in the United States. But most importantly, their battery supply chains, they have a complete chokehold on it when it comes to processing the minerals that go into virtually every battery in the world. So if you want to build a battery along that process of sourcing the minerals and processing the minerals, it goes through China. All roads go through China. They know that. And at any moment, they could cut that off. We've never really found ourselves in such a vulnerable position as we do with regards to battery supply chain in China today. So that's just one example. China's already taken it to solar panels and the shipbuilding industry and steel, one after another industries where they utterly dominate and overwhelm the West. Well, here we go again with the automobile industry and electrics and batteries. It's real. China has ambitions. Xi Jinping has come out and said, it is our time to take center stage in the world. The West is in decline. The East is rising, and it's now China's time. And this is the message that 1.3 billion Chinese citizens hear every single day. So as we were saying earlier with Hans, it's on right now. It's like a war by every other name. You know, they call it a trade war. There's also all kinds of examples of infiltration of the United States with TikTok and other channels to, you know, basically infiltrate the U.S. and shape opinions here in the United States too. So let's not underestimate the ambitions coming out of China. I think President Trump realizes that, and he says, it's time to say, hold it. Hold it. That's enough.
And Michael, can we pause there before we move much deeper into the conflict discussion on how much of China's dominance in some of these very critical industries like steel, like auto manufacturing, like batteries, like drones, how much of that is due to just the excellence of the Chinese people and their, you know, attention to detail and their work ethic and their ability to compete on a level stage, versus how much of it is due to government subsidies and industrial policy? And like, can we, you know, it's obviously this is going to be one of those nature versus nurture debates where it's not one or the other completely. It's going to be some of both. What's your estimation on, you know, how much of it is just Chinese culture versus Western culture, and how much of it is actually that, you know, they're robbing Peter to pay Paul, and there are parts of their economy that are actually suffering so that they can outcompete in these specific areas?
We have in China a country where, and a civilization, arguably a culture where there's a high degree of tolerance for pain and patience and suffering. So that goes back thousands of years. The emperor says this is where things are going to go, and the common person goes, okay, that's the program. I'll go along with that. That's always had how it's been. So to answer your question, though, based on all my years of experience in China, the Chinese people are very hardworking, very hardworking. They're smart. They're ambitious, not to be underestimated. So you have that. You have then you have the Chinese Communist Party recognizes this talent and this ambition and does an amazing job of harnessing it and channeling it towards targeted industries and then supporting it with every form and fashion of subsidy. So you've got, you know, the argument out there is, oh, China just subsidizes its way to global dominance. No, that's not accurate. Oh, China is just really hardworking, smart people. No, that's not completely accurate. It's both of those in tandem. And this is what's unsettling for us in the West because, you know, up until now, it's been Japan was a competitor or Korea or Germany. But they were allies, democratic countries, and we could have conversations about this. China's different. It's bringing to bear state capitalism and a very hardworking population. Whoa, how do we contend with this one? How do we compete?
Do we compete?
I think it's our thing is innovation. Has to be innovation. We're not going to outcompete them on costs. We have a hard time outcompeting them on scale. Impossible to outcompete them on state subsidies because they control their currency. They have all, they consistently give zero interest loans to their companies, free land, all the rest. We can't compete with that. The only hope we have is that we gather with our allies so we have comparable scale, and then we really, really go hard on innovation. And things you've talked about, you guys have talked about a lot with AI and robotics. That's where we have to have a sense of urgency that our hope, our solution to this conundrum is to innovate.
Yeah. Go ahead, Hans.
So where do tariffs play a role in this? Is it pointless for us to erect these trade barriers to China? Like, is the only way out innovation, or do we need, what is your assessment of what it seems like Trump's agenda is here at this point in time, and whether that is helpful, necessary, harmful, what have you?
There's like living in before I lived in China and after I lived in China answer. So after I lived in China, I saw what the power of tariffs could be. Let's make no mistake about it. China is the original king of tariffs. When they wanted to build powerful auto industry, the first thing they did is they put in place 100% duties on imports of cars. That was in the 1990s. If you want to sell cars in China, they said, you must manufacture inside China. We don't want imports. So then they didn't stop there. They said, if you're a GM and you want to manufacture and sell in China, you must form a joint venture with a Chinese partner and that partner will have 50% of the business. Okay, that's the cost of access to the China market. We couldn't export to the China market. We had to manufacture there, and half of our business we had to give away to the Chinese while playing an away game. So what happened? Yeah, actually, they drew hundreds of billions of dollars of investment from Toyota, Mercedes, Audi, GM, Ford, Hyundai, Honda, you name it. Everyone piled in, and it worked. They became a manufacturing powerhouse, not just because of tariffs alone, but tariffs plus the incentive to invest in manufacturing. So I can see a logic in what President Trump is doing. If one side has massive tariffs in place and you don't, you're wide open, vulnerable. Okay, if we don't like tariffs, but to compete in this new world, we have to set up walls to buy ourselves some time to innovate. That seems to be a realistic solution to the current competitive circumstance that we find ourselves in. No one likes tariffs. I get that. But yeah, without them, the Chinese would just roll in here and, you know, deliver cars at 25% less cost. And what happens to our industry, our jobs?
Yeah.
They get smoked.
I think that, and that's the interesting part of this discussion, is like, it's like the tariff variable is an important one to set up the incentive structure to domesticate production. But then the second variable is cultural. The second variable, like what you talked about, is like, okay, do you have enough people with enough willingness to want to take part of this world of manufacturing, which is very painful and it requires a lot of hard work? What is your assessment of that from where you sit?
I remember your comments from our last conversation, Far, that you're exactly right. If I compare my experience in China with my experience in the U.S. now, living back here 10 years after 26 years in Asia. In Asia, you wake up in the morning, there's an urgency to get something done because someone else will eat your lunch if you don't. There's almost, it's a pressure cooker. And
zero-sum game mentality.
You can argue about whether that's good or bad, but it's real. Yeah?
Oh, sorry. You lagged out there for a second. So a zero-sum mentality of types where it's like...
Zero.
Yeah.
That's right. A zero-sum mentality. I've got to go get after it because if I don't, someone else will take mine. It isn't always comfortable. When I lived in China, I never felt I could relax. But it's real. That's what they are. That's their normal reality. Coming back here to the United States, the Chinese go, oh, you guys live in a garden. It's so peaceful and quiet and lovely and beautiful and clean. You would have no urgency and no sense of panic at all. And that's where we find ourselves. How do we inject into the U.S. society that sense of, oh, Pearl Harbor's right around the corner, or Sputnik is there, we're behind. Oh, we could get smoked here. What are we? Let's move. Right now, we don't have that element in play, and I don't know how to create it short of some kind of cataclysmic event. Yeah.
Which is sort of a very scary thought. Go ahead, Hans. Dude, I could hog this podcast for like 2 hours. Go for it.
Well, I mean, it. Not to say that Trump is playing 4D chess, but it does support the idea of doing something that is incredibly disruptive to get everyone's attention and create mm-hmm. that sense of urgency. Mm-hmm. And I'm just struck by the difference in worldview that is inherent in the ideals of free and fair trade that's based on not a finite zero-sum game theory dynamic. That's based on an infinite game theory dynamic. And mm-hmm. so if you have a player, like, I just don't know how we play this infinite game that is free and fair global trade with a player who refuses to break out of a zero-sum finite game mentality. And I think that's really what the core of this tariff competition war, like, I mean, in the age of nuclear proliferation, war just looks different. And one of the terms that gets thrown around a lot is hybrid war. And I feel like we've been engaged in hybrid war 3.0 or hybrid world war 3.0 for some time now. And most of the rest of the world has been asleep at the wheel in recognizing that this is the situation, ourselves included. And I think that Liberation Day was one of the days that historians will look back on and say, that was a day when the dynamics changed. Excuse me, when the dynamics changed forever. And it's like a demarcation. The old world is over. The new world has just begun. And now we are trying to determine, what will this new world be? What will it look like? Who will come out on top? And who will, be in a tough place for the coming century?
He had the courage to call out China in his first administration. No one else did. So it was really the first president since Nixon normalized to say, hey, we kind of have a problem here. Let's address it. And here we are. There are all kinds of risks. You know, we've lived in a dollar-dominated world forever in our lifetimes. What if it moves away from that? That's a risk. What if China, Russia get together, North Korea? And that's a powerful combination. I think they already are. We're finding out there's Chinese soldiers in Ukraine. What? So there's so many, if you step back and think about it, I think you're exactly right, Hans. We're engaged in, sorry to say, World War III. Hopefully it'll be a short one. Short-lived.
So that's a scary thought, right? Mm-hmm. That's a scary thing to think about, because, you know, we sort of highlighted the existential nature of the back and forth, and what we see domestically is a lot of the, and again, this is why U.S. media is such a huge disappointment.
Garbage pile.
Yes, thank you for saying it the nice way. how is this not part of the broader analysis of the situation? How is this not part of the discussion that why aren't there 5-hour long pieces or whatever to really understand the fundamental nature of the partnership and the fundamental things that have happened from starting that partnership and the US's role in strengthening China? And which benefits the Chinese people tremendously, but are we really fully grasping what that means? Like, have we come to terms what it means to partner with a country that they have wonderful people, they have a government that's hell-bent on dominating, not very dissimilar from the United States in a lot of different ways, but they do it very different ways. I'm not trying to excuse the United States when I say this stuff. I just say, like, are we all understanding what's going on? And then repeated practices where and this, Hans sort of outlined this perfectly, where the Western nations would like to engage in free trade, but then when you are partnering with a country that whose track record is to attract with the intent to take your IP or, you know, learn from you as fast as possible, and then there, and you know, like the example we've used with the legacy automakers, Michael, the Europeans and the Americans, right? It's like, okay, we got what we needed. Thank you very much. Oh, we're so sorry. It's taking so long to help you. Oh, yeah, sorry. Oh, man. Oh, BYD has done 10 times more approvals and stuff. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Right? So it's like, okay, how do you compete?
You died. How did that happen?
Yeah. So sorry you died. I wonder what happened there. How do you compete with that? Like, legit, how do you compete with that? You know?
Yeah. Right. And the signs have been on the, I remember when I first got to China, lived in China in the late 80s, so long ago, there was this idea, Deng Xiaoping was a leader and he came out with this big program. We're going to reform and open our economy. They called it Gai Ge Kai Fang. Every Chinese person heard it every day on the news. Reform and open. So reform meant giving a little bit more power to the cities and provinces to make economic decisions. And opening meant bringing in foreign investment, capital and money, capital and know-how. When Westerners heard reform and opening, we think, oh, great, they're opening up China to us. They want us in there. They're really hungry to get us in there. Different meanings, yeah? And I remember this one speech, famous speech by Deng Xiaoping at the time. He said, oh, every Chinese person should know, when we open up the windows, there will be some mosquitoes and flies that get in here too. But we'll have to just fight those mosquitoes and flies and tolerate them until we have enough fresh oxygen to run on our own. Said it out loud, like the foreign capital and know-how is a necessary requirement for us to get from A to B. But long term, we know where we want this thing to go. So,
wow. So, like, they openly, I mean, just openly said it, and like from decades ago. And if that's one thing that China does extremely well, which is, you know, one of the benefits of being a communist government, the successful one at that, is that you can set the vision for 50 or 100 years down the road and you'll get there, because the leadership is exactly the same and every action they take for decades will be aligned with that thought process.
That's right.
Yeah.
So when I ask my Chinese friends, when I talk about Americans or American business people, what's the first adjective that comes to mind? And consistently the answer is naive. They see us at night. Impatient and naive. So we want, let's get some business together. Oh, by the way, you should probably be aware that you're stepping into a risky arena here. Never mind. That'll work out. That'll be fine. So here we are.
And this is where, like, culturally, they value mission and the China end goal more than capitalism and personal wealth, right? And again, this is like the cultural divide that when you're at the superpower level, they're two fundamental different ways of thinking about the world and thinking about their country and thinking about themselves, you know? Hans, go ahead before I ask another.
I would just say that all three of us have lived abroad, and I think it's much easier when you have lived abroad to understand that we as a monolingual Americans just completely do not appreciate how cultural differences, how important they are and how powerful they can be. Mm-hmm. So until you have been outside the country for a significant amount of time, you are just going to naturally underestimate the significance of the differences that we're talking about. And that is, to Michael's point, a recipe for being naive and accepting unknown risks that you did not even realize existed. And then it's doubly so when we are both impatient and naive, which is, you know, our cultural proclivity to do. So anyways, just for the audience, I wanted to double click on that point and emphasize how important it is.
Yeah. And I think on top of that too, is like, what I try to refrain from is like, this is not like good versus evil thing, or like a, this is just two very different cultures and two very different ways of life, where one party has been the superpower for decades and they've had the unipolar world, whatever, the monopolar world, whatever. They've been the singular power. And then you have a country that has made tremendous strides towards becoming a rival to that one power. But that party directly benefited from that other superpower willing to give them the market.
Yes.
Right? And that gets lost in this discussion. It's like the United States is personally responsible for getting China to where they are. And so from like a leverage perspective, and this is kind of like what I want to talk about, like tactics a little bit now, it's like from a leverage perspective, that seems like the United States is very well positioned to, let's say, if they are in conflict, to let's say impact some pain or to use their leverage to try and negotiate, right? Mm. But I think what's very important to keep in mind here, though, is that is the United States capable of absorbing the pain they're going to suffer when they impact the leverage? Because we have the debt problem, we've got the cultural problem, we've got a media landscape that has generated a ton of division, right? And for something like this to work, there has to be some sort of unity for all of us to understand, like, hey, we're about to get into something nasty here. Mm-hmm. And then on the Chinese perspective, you have a collapsing demographic, you have a real estate in shambles, right? You have a collapsing demographic, a real estate in shambles. You had the Communist Party literally give money to Chinese residents to invest in the stock market, to prop up their markets, right? So it's like both countries are,
and their debt issue is way worse than ours. Like, if ours is bad, theirs is god awful.
Yeah, and COVID has highlighted this over reliance on China. And we've already had foreign investment pulling out, part of it because of China, but also part of it because they're realizing, holy crap, I can't have all my eggs in one basket. So the weaknesses are everywhere for everybody to see. The question becomes, who has less weaknesses than the other one? And this is where I want to ask your...
Let me add one more dynamic there, is that there's a growing awareness in Asia Pacific theater amongst all of our allies, Korea, Japan, Australia, that China is a growing military power, and they are shifting military resources away from defending themselves against Russia and directing those resources towards defending themselves from China. And so this is not, you know, our allies are not asleep to the fact that there is an impending significant military risk that they're being faced with when it comes to China. And so while, you know, trade, people may get their feelings hurt about how the negotiations are playing out, I think the fundamental reality of the military picture on the ground is going to be hard for these people to escape from.
One of the things that, if we think about where China's vulnerable, they understand that historically, the United States has done a good job of getting together with allies. So if the U.S. is able to unite with Japan, Korea, Europe, Canada, and Mexico, Australia, then all of a sudden, China's feeling isolated. And China has this system of accumulated massive capacity in industries and exporting those products globally at low cost. If for some reason they start not having access to those markets, they have a risk of just drowning in massive overcapacity at home. So this is why it's so important, I think, for the United States. And Jamie Dimon from JP Morgan said this last week. It's like, let's get together with our allies. We'll need them to have the scale and unity. This is what China fears the most. Yeah. The other thing, I like what you said, Farzad, there's just two different competing systems. You got market capitalism here. You have state capitalism over there. They think they're right. We like our system. But China really benefited enormously from entering the WTO in 2001 in the category of a developed country, so it didn't really have to open up its market. And it had full access to Europe and the United States overnight. And that's when I saw firsthand just sensational growth of the Chinese economy. Like, you can't believe like what a party it was from 2010 to 2000 to 2020, basically. Unfettered access to world markets while not giving up much at home. So U.S. definitely had a role to play in that. Now they're looking to your question is, now they're saying, it's enough, we're going to shut you off from the U.S. Which society is better equipped to tolerate the pain that's coming in the coming months and years?
Exactly.
Yeah. The Chinese have an expression they call churku, which the Chinese expressions sound great in Chinese. They never translate great in English, but it means to eat bitter. And it's like a point of pride. Oh, the Chinese can eat bitterness better than anyone else in the world. Watch us. So that's the message going out in China today is, be prepared to eat bitter for the next several years. No problem. This is what we Chinese do.
We can take the heat.
We can take the heat. Bring it. And Americans are like, I need my cheap stuff. Whoa, what do you mean? I want cheap. Come on.
And that's the active. So I just want to make this clear. That's the active sort of, I don't know, active, but that's the messaging that's being heard across China. Is that sort of like, yo, get ready. Something's about to go down.
They're 100% with their words are, we can eat better than anyone else, and we will fight to the end. We're preparing for a war of attrition, basically, with the United States. Oh, by the way, the other messaging happening in China is the United States is actively trying to suppress us, keep us down, do us no good. We have done nothing wrong here in China. It's all the Americans trying to hold us down. So you have that same messaging over and over. By the way, there's no TikTok, there's no Google, no Gmail, no YouTube, no Facebook, no what, X, no, zero in China. You have one voice. And it's just hammering away. The U.S. is trying to keep us down. They're unreliable. Oh, the other ironic thing is they're calling U.S. protectionist. You know, and so I say, protectionist. Let's take a look at imports of cars last year. China imported 3% of total sales last year, three in a market of 25 million, three. U.S. imported 48%. So don't tell me about, but that's the messaging they're putting out, not only inside China, but globally. Look at America closing up. It's so protectionist. Well, the original masters of protectionism, the Great Wall didn't get there by accident. It's like, yeah, the Chinese know all about the benefits of protecting. They've been doing it. They'll continue to do it. So I would love for Americans to be more aware of these realities rather than just focused on, oh, we shouldn't have tariffs because it's going to increase the cost of X, Y, and Z. There's a lot more to this picture than just tariffs.
So one of the questions I've had is listening to different points of view with respect to the CCP's ability to carry out their policies and sustain this pain, like you said, to be able to eat bitter. Some people say that, you know, the CCP is on the verge of collapse, that Chairman Xi is, you know, his grip on power is tenuous, that there's all of these military purges that have been going on, and they'll look to this, that, and the other dynamic that they can observe in China and say, this is evidence that, you know, the whole thing is about to collapse like a house of cards. And then you have other people that say that Chairman Xi has basically unlimited power and support, and that he can do whatever he wants for as long as he wants. To whomever he wants with inside of the country, and that there, you know, there's not going to be any internal limitations to what he can and cannot do in this negotiation and the prosecution of whatever this hybrid war looks like. What do you make of that?
He's in good shape. He's in good shape. It's tempting to believe or subscribe or embrace the narrative that China is on the verge of cracking and collapsing and falling apart. But all my years in China say that it's larger than Xi Jinping. He's a guy who came along and decided now is the time for China to make its move. But if it weren't him, I could see another person following the same path. And in that one-party system today, he's accumulated more power than anyone since Chairman Mao by far. They call him the chairman of everything. He has control of the military. He has control of resources. He has control of the financials. There's nobody on the horizon that's a threat to him. Now, having said that, in any kind of, what do they call it, autocracy or dictatorship, you don't know until you know. Then suddenly the next day he's gone. What's happened? But all signs from people I talk to on the ground in China is that he's there. He's there for many years to come. And he's hell-bent on, number one, bringing Taiwan back to mainland China. That's a chorus you hear all the time inside China. And then number two, it's China's time to take center stage to replace the United States as the leading world superpower. So, as much as it's tempting to believe that, yeah, China is vulnerable, and it has its problems for sure. But, for example, property market has been a disaster, but they're playing with monopoly money. Their currency isn't subject to the same, you know, pressures that other currencies are around the world. They can just print more money. It's all sort of self-contained. So that's a long... I'd like to give a short answer. I think the short answer is probably need to.
You can give a long answer, Michael. You can give a long answer. It's okay.
prepare for Xi Jinping being there in place for many years to come still.
Let me ask you sort of like, I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this or I would love to hear your opinion on this, but do you think that there is a conflict of interest in the United States because so many business folks in the States have been addicted to the Chinese growth story, and they're making money hand over fist? You know, I know many people that have relocated to China, are directly, you know, whatever. There's a way for them to make money through the Chinese market, and they can see that there's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% GDP growth, and they don't want that gravy train to stop, right? And those people might be citizens or dual citizens or whatever, and those folks have a lot of influence and power, and they are, I don't want to say controlling government, but they have a lot of influence, and they're in the ears of a lot of people, and the last thing they want is this gravy train to stop. So they're not so much worried about the United States, they're worried about their pocketbooks, and it's almost like the Chinese have, like, you know, not on purpose maybe, but like, they found themselves in a position where even Americans don't want America to be America first because they like the growth in China. Like, do you think that is a fair, like, am I conspiracy theorist or like, do you think there's something there?
Not at all. The extent to which China has infiltrated U.S. society goes way beyond our wildest imagination. Your example, you know, people on the ground here who openly advocate at the local level and in the federal level, we should keep ties with China open. We should continue this relationship. I see this a lot. You know where I see it a lot, and I was really surprised by it when I first returned from China, Silicon Valley. I couldn't get over the number of entrepreneurs, and maybe they don't know any better, but all they can see is we keep those doors open because that's money. And I think, don't you think there's a trade-off, guys? Aren't you? Let's not be naive. What's actually going on here? So the Chinese have big advocates on the ground here in business and in universities. If you guys have looked at the amount of money that China has donated to the best universities in the United States, you have to wonder, what are the universities thinking? We'll just take this money because the Chinese like us. No, there's something beyond that going on. And then the third one I heard when I was in D.C. last week was that the extent to which Chinese companies have infiltrated our infrastructure is frightening. Our water systems, our power systems, we're extremely vulnerable, so much so that the people I talked to in D.C. said that the Biden administration, which uncovered this, decided not to go very public with it because they feared of setting off a panic in the U.S. So the Chinese are in our society. We're not in theirs. They have a huge voice here. We don't have any voice there. It's one really one-sided, and it's another example of, you know, a closed society being able to take advantage of an open society. What do we do about that? We don't want to become a closed society, but how do we contend with a force as strong as China?
Give me some examples of the, I mean, you're freaking me out. So what are some examples of those, the infiltration? I know, like, some of the ones that we've talked about before, like the drone equation is one that I know we've brought up. It's like, hey, like, China makes all the drones. The U.S. has like no capacity to make drones, right? We talked about the telecommunications. I think, was it Huawei or I forget who the, it was from a few years ago that they were making 5G antennas or something, right?
Huawei.
Is that the kind of thing, like maybe like materials or like specific supply chain things that only China has the access to manufacturers? Is that the example?
That's right. Rare earths. Says just, no.
those are examples, but it goes much deeper.
I see. Uh-huh. Okay, go ahead, Michael.
There were the story that came out a couple of years ago is the cranes moving stuff around in our ports all featured some special, what do you call, surveillance equipment so that China could measure what's coming in and out from where at any time and report that back in real time. So, we'd all love to get along. Like, the thing that puzzles me is China was doing extremely well with its engagement with the West, becoming affluent and powerful on its own. And that at a certain point, Xi Jinping, 2014, with his Made in China program, said, it's not enough to become wealthy and powerful within a system created by the United States. We want to go the next step. We actually want to write the rules and set the standards and have other people listen to us. And that's where, you know, if the United States definitely planned for the former, that China would just join the existing community of nations in this as the global economy, but that's not how it's played out. So we're caught like, ooh, what now?
Yeah. And the unfortunate reality of this too is like the United States is no saint either in the global stage. That's that's the thing, you know. It's like, you know, maybe not with our allies, let's say, but or like, you know, our closest allies. You know, I don't know if the United States has to spy on the UK, because I mean they're already so integrated, you know, like the both societies are so like intertwined in a lot of different ways. It's like you don't really have to do much extra work, I don't think. Anyway, who knows, they might, but that's me being naive. See that? I'm sure the United States is doing some sort of crazy stuff over there. But even if we set that aside, to me it seems like, how do we avoid the inevitable? Or how do we avoid a scenario, not the inevitable, how do we avoid inevitable destruction, which is that all this sort of a relationship escalates to where you're going to have two cultures that have all the power, or most of the power, they're sort of equals, and then they are actively vying for the world to be made in their vision, which again, the United States has sort of had that luxury for the last 50, 60, 70, 80 years. And, you know, as many bad things that the United States has done, they've also, you know, they're the most democratic country, hopefully, you know, they have a lot of freedoms. Like they're trying to give the individual a lot of power, let's say from a vision perspective, let's say, but, how do you foresee this ending up? I mean, this is a super loaded question, but do you think this forces China's hand to actually be more open, like for the United States to actually get in the market, and maybe the U.S. says, okay, if you do that, we'll let you get NVIDIA chips, you know, because the AI discussion is a whole separate one that if we have time, I'd like to talk about here, because I think that's a huge point of leverage. But how do you see this playing out in the next? And because again, this is not next week, like in the next 5-10 years, where do you think this is going?
Thought it was super interesting that one of the first moves the Trump administration made was the Panama Canal. If you guys remember, Hutchinson Whampoa, Hong Kong company controlled by the Communist Party of China, has those two huge port facilities there. And the United States said, no. Those are coming to us. And there's a deal that's been made that the U.S. is acquiring that. I think it's BlackRock. Now, the CCP in the meantime has come out and said, hold it, we don't approve of that deal. So where am I going with this? I could see the United States saying, let's be realistic about the future. The chances of us coming to a deal, some kind of peaceful deal with China, pretty limited. So let's secure our hemisphere from Greenland, Canada, Mexico, all the way down to Panama. With Mexico, we have the labor. With Canada, we have the resources. Here, we have the innovation and the military. Wow, that would be a pretty strong commonwealth. And yes, it means letting go. We don't have the resources to cover the globe anymore. What that leaves open is what happens to Europe, what happens to Japan and Korea. But it seems to be, at least under the Trump administration, a realistic view of the world going forward. Can we realistically hold on in Asia when China is so powerful there? What about Europe? Let's first take care of stuff at home. So I could see a world in which there's China plus in Asia. There's Europe. Don't know where that's going with Russia. And the United States saying, you know, it's not a bad thing to have the entire hemisphere secure for ourselves.
And so that's such an interesting observation, too, because the whole, you know, from the second it took office, like you said, the Panama Canal, but then also like the whole Canada 51st state, Greenland 52nd state.
Yeah.
Like it sounds ridiculous on the face of it. And I'm not advocating for us to go and take those countries at all. But
no.
I do think that. Within the context of what has happened with China with the tariffs in the last couple of weeks, it's so fascinating you bring that up. Like that's sort of what it's going towards. Like the momentum is starting to point us towards that direction, where it's much more likely for the physical bodies, that the geography of the world dictates who the allies are, and then those areas are then responsible to ensure They have everything they need to survive for the next 10, 20, 50 years. And mm-hmm. one of the biggest things that's coming down the pike in the next 10, 20, 50 years is the advent of artificial intelligence and how that's going to impact absolutely everything and mm-hmm. the energy required to power those systems. And if you're an area that you don't that doesn't have that locked down, you lose. You mm-hmm. lose so hard, right? So before we keep going, because we're about to hit the hour mark, but are you good to keep going for a little bit longer?
Yes, okay. I'm here. No more. Perfect. No more earthquakes. I'm here with you.
Okay, perfect. So what's your read on the AI piece as we're talking about it from a point of leverage? Do you think that is a true point of leverage today, or do you think that needs some more time to materialize? Who is better positioned? I'd love to get sort of your thoughts on that.
It feels like the United States does have a decisive advantage when it comes to AI today. It also is a reality that China is racing as fast as it can to equal us. So just like in growing up, we used to have the nuclear arms race, we're going to have an AI arms race, and it's going to feature US and China against each other. So I see us going from, remember in manufacturing first, for years it's been just in time, and now we're moving to a world of just in case. And I feel as though they're consolidating, as you said, around our hemisphere to say, hey, it's no longer realistic to think that we have access to global markets. China's not going to open up. China's not going to open up to the US. In fact, I don't know what deal we would have with the tariffs. Say, if the United States agrees to back off our tariffs, what's China going to give? Probably very little, to be realistic. I don't know what would we ask for. They would, one way or another, say the tariffs go to zero. The Chinese have all kinds of non-tariff barriers to still sort of discourage or stop our business going that way. I mean, they already do it today with social media. There's no social media platform from America that's accessible in China. No one talks about that. You know, like, hey, hello. They're already stopping us at the border. So AI, two AI superpowers in two different hemispheres. The wild cards are Europe and then Japan, Korea. Do they sort of become... If you think of, if President Trump went to Canada, Greenland, and Mexico and Panama tomorrow and said, let's create the American Commonwealth, I think that would be somehow much more acceptable. That looks good. And then plus our allies, Japan, Korea, and maybe France, Germany, and England, something like that. Seems to be the outline of where things are headed today.
And then you said you're not really sure about Europe, and I'm gonna throw something out there, which might be very controversial. But I feel like, man, my European viewers might hate me. I love everybody. I just want to be very clear. It feels like, at least from the last 10, like the last 4-5 years, ever since COVID, it's become apparent that a lot of European nations, it seems like they embrace a more controlled society than the United States does from a cultural perspective. You know, you saw the things out of Germany, I believe, where they're cracking down on speech. The UK is cracking down on speech, mm-hmm. right? And these are things that are very much telltale signs of more dictatorial type societies, autocratic societies, you know, not as free and open. And from a cultural perspective, I feel like European nations are much more communal. They're much more about the collective than the individual. And again, I might be misreading this completely, and there are obvious exceptions to this. But one of my fears, fear is the wrong word. One of the things I'm looking for is if the EU is a more natural ally to China than the United States because of those cultural things. And I tell me if I'm thinking about this incorrectly, if I'm going up the wrong tree, because that's especially when the EU came out and said, and you know, people said this is not accurate or whatever, but they're trying to make a free trade agreement with China for them to sell Chinese cars into the market with zero tariffs. I'm like, you're just going to kiss BMW. Just, you just basically put a nail in the coffin of every single European automaker. What are you? Are you? Why do you hate yourself so much? Right. That was my that was my gut reaction. Tell me. And I don't know how familiar you are with the European market, but like, am I thinking about this incorrectly?
No, you're right on. I was just in Spain last month, and Chinese cars are pouring in there at record rates. And you're right. Last fall, the EU Commission did come out and announce tariffs on Chinese imports, EV imports. Last week, they're revisiting it, saying, hey, maybe that was a mistake. We should drop tariffs on Chinese imports to zero. It doesn't make any sense. You know, they're going to get overwhelmed by this machine coming out of China. China has capacity to supply half the world's demand for cars, half. One of every two cars China could supply if they needed to. Europe looks like they look at Europe and say, wow, let's go. So if they get zero tariffs there, they're just going to roll in. Now, why might that be happening? Keep in mind, and I don't know this is how well this is known, but Mercedes-Benz, arguably the most iconic German brand, automotive brand in the world, the majority ownership is Chinese today. 19.5% shares belong to Geely and Beijing Auto Industry Corporation. They have a seat at the board. And if you look at what the CEO of Mercedes-Benz says, oh, we're against any tariffs on Chinese imports, you have to believe who's running the show there. Then you go to the UK, you're going to see MG brands all over the streets. Most British customers think that's, oh, the comeback of the century, our national icon, MG. No, it's a Chinese-owned company, and the cars are coming from China. Then you go, wander over to Sweden, and you go, it's Volvos. I love Volvos. And those Polestars are good-looking, too. And, oh, by the way, those are Chinese-owned, too. So to a large extent, the Chinese have already woven themselves into Europe politically and economically. The Spanish are super happy to have them. Maybe Chery or BYD have built a plant there. There's one going into Hungary. It looks like Europe's tilting more towards China suddenly than it is toward the United States.
And that's the variable that I'm trying to wrap my head around, because Russia and China are extremely good friends.
Yes.
And so for the Europeans to side with China here, when they are so up in arms about Russia invading Ukraine, can somebody help me understand what that's about?
Hans,
like, honest question. Yeah. Like, am I dumb thinking about like that being the dumbest idea of all time, to partner with your enemy's biggest ally?
It's totally confusing to me. Okay. Unless what I hear from my German friends is they say, I feel as though, fairly or not, they were spoiled with U.S. protection for so long, and now the U.S. sort of spoke directly to them, they're upset. They don't like it. So it's like your one parent scolded you, so you're going to go to the other. Well, I'm done with you. I don't even like the other one, but right now I like the other one more than I like you. That seems to be the feeling on the ground these days.
Yeah, I'll show sure you, America. Like, yeah, it sure looks like cutting off your nose to spite your face from the outside, because I don't understand how this is not abundantly clear. And it is very telling what's going to happen with the auto sector, because you would think that the auto sector would be the first, like, it sure seems like the entire EU caters itself around whatever the demands of the German auto sector elite are. Like, they are really the ruling class of the EU almost, and so whatever they want, if they are leaning towards China, that is a, I guess maybe the auto industry isn't looking at Russia, and they, like, yes, the people of Germany and the people of Europe are up in arms about Russia. But if the auto industry is looking towards China instead of away from China, and they don't care about Russia, maybe. It's very, very hard to parse.
The other interesting narrative there about Germany is, of course, they do sell a ton of cars in China and make huge profits. The premiums, Mercedes, BMW, and Audi sell twice as many cars in China than they do here in the United States. So the Germans have justified their actions, saying, well, we have to be gentle and careful with China, otherwise they might not buy our cars there anymore. Hello, the Europeans in this instance might be even more naive than the Americans. They're not going to buy your cars anyway as soon as they don't have to. And already we're seeing sales of German cars going down in China. So they're, it's like a false hope. Oh, if we're just nice to them and let them in here, they'll be nice to us. Not necessarily.
Yeah. And this is where, you know, this is where the discussion, I don't know if you can hear my kid banging on the something downstairs. No. Okay, good. The sound is working. Good. The sound canceling. He's having a blast. He's very talkative today. He's the best. So all of this paints a very bleak picture about the geopolitical tensions that are unfolding right before our eyes. At the surface level, it looks like Trump is being an idiot about tariffs, but the underlying thing is like, holy crap, do we have a clash of titans that is happening? Actively happening, and now it's been brought forward to the public eye, masked as a tariff discussion. But in reality, this is a fundamental thing that's happening in the world. The rejiggering of world powers. Ray Dalio covers this very, you know, the changing world order, right? You know, the nations in the rise and nations in decline. This could be all of that unfolding all at once. But the one unbelievable variable that, again, we talked about briefly here, the artificial intelligence. You tell me if this read is sort of, and I can't remember if we talked about this in our last discussion. I feel like we touched on it, but I feel like it's even more prescient to talk about now, because one of China's biggest competitive advantages by far is that manufacturing capacity, which is automated. But it's also powered by a lot of people. They have a lot of people. I think 24, 25% or something of China's working population is directly tied to manufacturing. And the West, specifically the United States, is spooling up the humanoid robot and automation sectors and artificial intelligence sectors at a pace that is faster than China, at least for now. And so what does that mean long term? That means that the United States all of a sudden can manufacture its own labor force at a cost per hour less than China's, which then says, okay, it just becomes a question of access to raw materials. So your factories filled with robots can make the things that you want and need, right? So do you think that's a legitimate sort of piece of the puzzle here that the United States has on its side that could tilt, let's say, the negotiations towards a good outcome for all parties involved, where you know, it doesn't turn into this whole like war of like attrition or like, you know, some sort of thing. It's like China is like, okay, at some point I'm going to lose my ability to leverage my workforce to power my factories to the United States anyway. So what's your read on that human or robot piece and the Chinese labor being disrupted through AI and automation?
If we look at other industries, autonomous vehicles or batteries or what have you, modern technologies, the U.S. has been leaders, consistently the leaders in innovation. Lithium ion batteries, simple example. The trouble is the Chinese have proven to be much more aggressive and much better at commercialization of those technologies. This is the dichotomy I see. U.S. invents, China commercialize. U.S. invents, China commercialize, not only inside China, but globally. So I believe the United States does enjoy tremendous leverage in the sense that we're the innovative capital of the world still. However, I think we need to be much more aggressive when it comes to commercializing globally to markets like in Southeast Asia, South America, Middle East, not just focus here on North America. Otherwise, the Chinese will to go China plus one. They're very good at going globally in a hurry. So the war, the battles might be fought in third countries, not between us, but in other markets around the world. That's what I'm watching.
That's actually very eye-opening insight there. What do you think, what role do you think Elon Musk is playing in all of this? And the reason
I'm just so happy he's on our side. Imagine a world where he's Russian or Chinese. Oh my goodness, not good.
Man.
We're so fortunate to have him on our side. Couple things he said recently. One of course was we should have zero tariffs with Europe. That was a hint that maybe it's this hemisphere plus European partners. That was good news. The other one is that he is in a way telling Americans indirectly, he talks about the Chinese work ethic a lot. And I think that is an effort to make us here in America think twice, go, actually, well, it'll be great. We're great at innovation. What did we do day two with that innovation? How aggressively did we push that into market? So, yeah.
And there was something else you said too. Sorry, yeah. That with the raw, because I think this is very, very telling too. With the rare earth metals, where he said it's not about the metals being rare; they're plentiful. It's about refining capacity, and all the refining capacity is in China. But that doesn't feel like a fundamental bottleneck that the United States can't get to. That feels regulatory more than anything.
Regulatory, and that regulatory wall in the United States has gotten huge, super tall. So we need to shift our mindset. Well, wait a second. Isn't processing of rare earths, isn't that dirty? Yes, it is. It is dirty. That's a reality. Do we want our national security? Do we want to remain independent? We may have to give and take on the regulatory front. Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you said that. That's he just mentioned that. That's so important. Rare earths are not rare. It's just that most of the processing now goes through China. That's the bottleneck.
And it is so interesting to see like all these pieces are sort of starting to come together with like, you know, I think about some of the things that, and again, I want to set politics aside, but I do want to talk about like the platform of the Trump administration. It's like, you know, they talk about regulations getting out of hand. They talk, you know, they're always sort of like, say, you know, China's doing this unfairly, or manufacturing is hollowed out, right? It seems like they've, and this has been Trump's sort of like criticism from the very beginning. It's like he has his finger on the pulse of exactly what the biggest issues are, maybe his approach or how he communicates and how he goes about it that people have such a huge problem with. But it feels like that platform, that policy of trying to solve for these things, like if it doesn't get solved literally right now, the ship has sailed. It feels like it's literally now or never. And I think, and again, if I go back to our other discussions from before, it's like each time we talked the last two times, it's like it feels existential. It feels like something has to happen. Nothing's happening. Mm-hmm. It feels existential. Mm-hmm. Somebody's got to work on it. Nobody's doing anything. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, it's like everything's just happening all at once. Bam. Here you go. We're going to deal with it all at once. It's wild.
It is wild.
It's wild.
At very high stakes. How is this going to play out between the United States and China on the tariff front? They're both.
Who's going to blink first? Who's going to blink first, you think? Who do you think? You think Trump's already blinked?
Here's my take. I think that President Trump does not expect to get a deal with China. Does not expect it. He just wants to create maximum awareness of our realities today. So much so, 145,000, 145%. The message is we're at odds with this other country and they're not willing to negotiate with us. I haven't gotten a call. I'm trying my, let's talk. No, they don't want to talk. See, rest of the world, you guys come back to us. We can get together. And that would really put a fright into China. That's my read. I don't think that he's looking for a breakthrough arrangement with China that everyone's lives happily ever after. I don't think so.
So in that scenario where, you know, basically China's worst nightmare does come to pass and we're able to pull in Europe, we're able to pull in South Korea, we're able to pull in Japan, we're able to pull in Australia and basically and Vietnam, like just completely surround them and wall them off from the ability to export, and they are drowning in that overcapacity that you mentioned earlier. Does that mean that the risk of a much sooner invasion of Taiwan skyrockets?
There's so many risks out there right now. Yes. Yes. He'd say we're being surrounded. Well, let's consolidate our own country. Let's bring Taiwan back to the motherland. Okay, we have to bring Taiwan back to the motherland. That would be the chorus. Is that a risk? I think it's a risk, but I think China's determined to do it anyway. I think it doesn't change the calculus from Xi Jinping's mind right now. I don't think so.
It feels like
Do you think
Trump
the timeline
just...
changes, though, I guess, is my question. Yeah, like I do see them being determined, but the question is, you know, is it going to be...
Would it accelerate? That's a great question, Hans. Don't give me tough questions like this. I don't have
Why do you keep coming back, Michael?
It may be helpful. I was in D.C. last week, talked to senior people there. They said the chances of an invasion, military action by China on Taiwan within the next 6 months is about 35%. So that's much higher.
That seems high.
That's much higher.
I don't think the market is pricing that in.
No. And what would happen to TSMC? What would happen to chips? It could be catastrophic. Yeah. A couple other quick ones. Warren Buffett, if you remember, did say, they asked him, what do you think of tariffs? He said, tariffs are an act of war. He said that months ago. And you go, well, yeah. Why? Because we probably, in some way or another, are at war. And then President Trump, they asked him, what would you do to deter China from invading Taiwan? His answer back in October was, I'd throw so many tariffs at them that they'd understand the message. We're not asleep. We're ready. We understand what you want to do. Don't do it. So,
man.
Yeah.
God, I hope none of this comes. Oh, man. Okay. man, what was I going to ask about Taiwan? I was literally about to ask something, but
Taiwan.
This conversation is just so so brutal. Because
Japan and Korea, what would they do? Japan and Taiwan are very close. Very close.
Okay.
And China would not only have to contend with the United States, but almost certainly Japan would get in there, Australia, probably Korea. It would be ugly.
Be very, very ugly. And so go ahead, Hans. Please.
If you're Trump in this position and all of these cards are on the table, what are the carrots that you are extending to all of those players behind closed doors that people are not seeing? What is he telling South Korea? What is he telling Japan? What is he telling Australia and Vietnam?
What one read is, if you watch the way he speaks, and when he talks about adversaries like Russia and China, he talks in glowing terms about his great relationship. So, you know, good cop. And then I understand that when he sends his people to talk to those countries, it's a different story. And then conversely, on the surface, when he's talking to Canada or Mexico or South Korea or Germany, he's hammering them. But then underneath the surface, his people go and go, let's work something out here. Let's work something out. So that's my read. I could see him also doing the art of the deal where he goes, hey, I was going to charge everybody in the world 100% tariffs. It's only going to be 10% for our friends. And then the friends go, oh, only 10%. Oh, I guess, yeah, okay, we can probably live with that. And that's if there is a grand design, that would be it, to bring the allies back together and confront the biggest threat to their way of life that we've seen since World War II.
So that 90-day, and it goes back to like sort of how we started the podcast, is like that 90-day window is unbelievably important, because the one thing that Trump cannot risk at all, talking about legacy, talking about policy, talking about his administrative goals, if this gets pushed out to the fact where the United States does go into recession or worse, depression, because of the financial disturbances of not having clear guidance on tariffs, right? That will cause, that's going to ruin his ability for the House and the Senate to be on his side for the midterms, which is about 18 months. And so if this 90-day window turns out to be bad, kiss the midterms goodbye. And by default, kiss anything else you want to get done goodbye. It turns into a catastrophic president. basically, right? And so it's like, so yeah. The biggest signal, I think, and tell me if you agree with this, both of you, the biggest signal we'd be looking for, and it goes back to what you've been saying multiple times, Michael, the EU and America have to come to a deal. They have to come to something in the next 90 days or hopefully even sooner that says, this is how we're going to move forward from now on. And if they can put something in pen and paper where 450 million people, however big Europe is, that those people will bias towards the United States instead of China for commerce, then China has a forcing function to be like, okay, maybe we do have to come to the table. Even more so if Korea and Japan are able to, they make a deal with those guys in the next 90 days. If those two things happen, then this could be one of the greatest sort of like negotiations of all time. But if those two things don't happen, you have financial calamity for sure. And then that's even worse because then China has a weak United States that has a tremendous amount of infighting. And everybody knows this, right? Everybody knows this as a point of leverage. Even the EU would know this as a point of leverage. The question becomes, like, how far are you willing to play ball with the United States when in the public sphere, Trump is beating you over the head over and over and calling you greedy, lazy, right?
Yeah.
And then in the back, and he's like, but guys, listen, I'm just fucking around. Just know I got your back, but we got to make a deal, right? These are like the number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 signals is that EU has to come to a deal. Japan, South Korea, ideally Taiwan or Vietnam. These areas have to come to a deal in the next 90 days. It has to happen. It has to happen.
It isn't 5 years from now. It's not 5 months from now. It's like 90 days. A lot will be decided. You're right. You're absolutely right.
I'm terrified.
Han?
Thanks, Michael.
No, I think you crushed it. You just nailed it right there. It's either, what is it called? We united we stand, divided we fall. We alone, United States, cannot take on China. China will overwhelm us. So this is a little bit of history, but Chinese Civil War, I think, is highly useful to us look at history sometimes. 1945-49, Mao Zedong and the communists were in the countryside. Chiang Kai-shek, with the help of the United States, had set up bases along the coast. They break out in the civil war. And Mao Zedong said, here's our plan. We're going to take the entire countryside, surround the cities, and eventually overwhelm them. So if we look at China's strategy today, whether it's in autos or in other businesses, they're going into all the other markets around the United States, into South America, big time, Southeast Asia, Africa, Middle East, everywhere. And then guess what? You look at the map, they're taking the countryside, they're surrounding the crown jewel here in the United States. We have to reverse that trend. Otherwise, we're living on an island and surrounded by China and Chinese capabilities.
At least the Americas are a big island, and if we can secure the rest of the two continents, that is, to your point earlier about controlling the hemisphere, I think it is hard. You know, right now they're inroads to Canada, into Mexico, into South America. They're all trade-based inroads and, you know, cultural influence, soft power inroads. But the thing that I was reflecting on as you were talking about Farzad that scares me is the fact that if we don't come to a better resolution within 90 days, it does leave open the possibility for one or the other player to initiate some sort of hot war operation that will then galvanize the base. And so I wouldn't leave that off the table.
Yeah. Very complex, very existential. You know, the thing is like, you know, how many times have we heard of the Chinese boogeyman, right? Like it always gets brought up. It's like, hey, listen, like, you know, they talked about China taking over forever. They talked about China taking over forever. You know, it's not going to happen. But I feel like that's literally the time when it happens. It's like, you just have to look at the trends of what's happening underneath to understand that at some point China's going to hit critical mass. And again, like, yes, they have a lot of problems they have to fight through. So does the United States. So does Europe. I mean, Europe is having an insane amount of problems. They have insane overregulation. They have extremely fast shifting demographics and culture because of their approach with immigration, which I'm an immigrant. I'm a first generation immigrant in the United States. I love immigration, but like you have to be very, some of the decisions that European countries have made have been very, very interesting.
Have to be orderly about it, right? Immigrate. Exactly. You can't do. Uh-huh.
Canada, disruptive.
Similar situation, just overwhelmed. Oh, we, they no, too much too fast.
Yeah, exactly. So everything, the world feels like it's a little bit in chaos right now. So it's the old saying of like, you know, sometimes days happen in years, and then sometimes years happen in days. Yes. It really feels like we're living through that time right now. And I'm always so thankful to have somebody like you to bring on, Michael, because you give us the ability to think about a part of the world that. I mean, I know Hans and I are both not nearly as familiar with it as we should be. And somebody like you that can come on and help us think through that and understand that deeply is insanely valuable, because then we can properly think about the risks, and we can probably think about all the different things that are going on that could impact just everything, like good or bad. So we just have understanding. We have more understanding and more clarity. And in our media landscape of today, that's so unbelievably difficult to achieve. And we just want to thank you very much for making the time and coming on. And please come on again, because we're probably going to have you on a lot. I hope that's okay.
I always enjoy the conversation with you guys, because it's fresh, original, honest. And we're working at getting to what's going on here.
The truth. We just want the truth.
Really, yeah. What's going on? Yeah, exactly. Awesome.
Yeah, man. All right, thank you so much. Yeah. Hans, did you want to throw anything in before we give Michael a chance to plug his stuff?
Just, yeah, want to highlight and echo thank you for your wisdom. It's incredible to have someone who has your experience be able to participate in these conversations with us two bozos and help everyone who is thinking about these issues have a much more in-depth perspective. And also, you know, I think the there's a type of national service that you have provided to, like, yes, we were trying to do business with China, we were trying to grow, and we may have made some missteps in our industrial policy along the way, and mm-hmm. your willingness to just speak openly about your experiences and help everyone to learn from the things that have happened over the past 3-4 decades. Mm-hmm. So that we can be more prepared for the future. I'm so thankful for, all of your perspective and your service in that.
Thank you. If I could have one ask of people out there, it's just that China for most of our lives has stayed at home. It's not staying home anymore. So let's start today to prepare, understand. If you have to ask the average Chinese person 100 questions about America, they're going to score really high. If you ask the average American 100 questions on China, for most of us, again, is like not doing great. So let's understand who they are, where they're coming from, what they want to get done.
Yeah. Love it. Where can people find you, Michael?
Easiest way on X is done_insights, or go to the website, doneinsights.com.
Love it. Thank you, Michael.